This episode of To the Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Garrett Wong. I played Ensign Harry Kim on Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To the Journey. I'm your co-host, Liam Smart, and with me, as always, is...
Zachary Frueling.
How are you, Zach?
I'm doing great, Liam. It's great to be back recording for the second time in as many weeks.
I know. It's good to try and get ourselves back to a schedule, isn't it?
Well, after the long hiatus that Suzanne and I had, it's great to be recording regularly again.
Yeah. And listeners, Suzanne should hopefully be back next time with us. She's almost sorted out her technical difficulties. We were trying to record with her today, but she is in the kitchen with Neelix making up some lovely New Year's delicacies from what she's been telling us.
We'd like to say all of us will be together again, but really it will be all of us together for the very first time.
Exactly. Yes, because I still haven't met Suzanne on camera and on mic, have we? So all together.
And you've been missing out.
I have. It's going to be a lot of fun when we get back together for the first time. So today we're going to be talking about the episode 1159, the season 5 episode of Voyager, that deals mostly in the year 2000 with a certain non-Voyager character played by Kate Mulgrew. What did you think of the episode overall for initial thoughts, Zach?
Yeah, this has been an interesting episode for me. For years, felt this episode fell dramatically short for me. It feels a little flat, even though I love seeing Kate Mulgrew playing a different character. Any time you get a chance to see one of your favorite actors playing a different character, especially in the show that they're known for, is always a fun experience. So it's great from that standpoint. And for me, the things I find interesting about the episode have to do with the subject matter and the connections. I've always been into ancestry and genealogy and my family history, much like Captain Janeway is, even though she has a lot to learn about her ancestor, Shannon O'Donnell. So I find the episode sort of conceptually interesting because I can relate it to my own interests, more so than the episode being dramatically interesting. But to me, it raises interesting questions about how you get from there to here, you know, without going into Star Trek Enterprise, how you move from the present, overcome all the obstacles, people who are stuck in the past, people who don't want to change and be progressive, all the societal and economic changes that it takes to get from the world we live into the world of Star Trek, and the changes people have to make along the way in order to get there if they think that's important. So I think this episode is an interesting look at what it would take to go from the 20th century, now the 21st century, into the Star Trek future and some of the small hiccups that might come along the way, the changes people would have to make, the changes economies would have to make, the changes societies and cultures and even a little bookstore like this that's in danger of going out of business, I think is an interesting question. You know, if the economy is going to change, we're going to move ourselves into the future, then people are going to have to change. And change is always a little uncomfortable. So it's an interesting question about how much change we're willing to bear as a society to move ourselves into the future.
Yeah, no, I agree. I said to you before we started recording, 1159 has never been an episode that I've remembered fondly. I mean, it's not one of my favourite episodes, and I doubt it's many people's favourite episode. But upon watching it again last night, it raised a lot of important questions, and I found that it is a lot more interesting than I actually first thought. I mean, I haven't watched it since about 3 years ago before last night, and I guess the way we see the future going, it's very much the same as what Henry Janeway thought the future was going as well for him.
And yet this is the first episode you wanted to talk about in your tenure on To the Journey, even though it's not one of your favorite episodes and you hadn't watched it in a long time. What made you think of this episode? Because you chose this episode to talk about.
So I did.
What made you think of 1159 as the first episode you wanted to talk about?
It's the new year.
I guess that's true. It is the new year. It's officially, we're recording this on New Year's Day.
And
for me,
it's
January 2nd for you. Yep, exactly. Yeah, so, Happy New Year, by the way.
And you too, and Happy New Year to the listeners as well.
To everyone, to all of our listeners.
Yeah, no, so I chose the episode purely because I thought, it's going to be January the 1st, January the 2nd when we record. It's an episode about, I guess, new beginnings overall, especially for the town of Portage Creek in Indiana. Was it Indiana? Yeah, Indiana. And I just thought, well, why not? Let's have a chat about it. And yeah, as I said, it's brought up a lot of interesting topics that we can discuss. So is that, what did you think about Shannon O'Donnell? I find it particularly interesting that she really does parallel Catherine Janeway quite a bit. Obviously, that is Kate Mulgrew playing her, but right down to the little personality quirks as well, they appear.
Well, that's a really interesting question. To what extent do you inherit your personality traits genetically? You know, can even across hundreds of years, can you be so genetically similar to your ancestors that you have the same personality traits, same interests, same overall temperament, those kinds of things? And how much of that is cultural? How much of that is learned and acquired either through your family or through society or some other influences you might have? I think it's fascinating that an ancestor of Captain Janeway's would be so similar to her in personality and temperament, and yet different in some key ways, too. I mean, she's not just a carbon copy of Captain Janeway. She's got her own demeanor and her own... she's not as much of an explorer as Captain Janeway had given her credit for. So the sort of mythology, the family mythology that Captain Janeway had about her is not terribly accurate. And yet they do have some fundamental interests and abilities and sensibilities in common.
Hmm. Well, we know Shannon O'Donnell likes her coffee, just like Janeway.
Yeah. That's definitely cultural, right?
Yeah, definitely.
The Janeway family for centuries has been having coffee black.
I think Henry gave her some decaf coffee. I thought, will she say coffee black?
You think anyone on Voyager ever slipped Janeway some decaf coffee? Like, you know, just for your own good, Captain.
I kind of hope so.
Well, Chakotay often said she drank too much of that stuff.
Well, I mean, for her to stay up, the amount that she did through certain episodes should have been living off of coffee, wouldn't she? So yeah, like Shannon O'Donnell, she's on her own journey as well. She's been made redundant effectively from her job as an engineer. She didn't make it into astronaut school, if that's what you want to call it. Mm. Both of them are worried about being stuck somewhere. Janeway is stuck in the Delta Quadrant, and Shannon O'Donnell specifically said to Henry Janeway that she doesn't want to get stuck at the bookstore for the rest of her life. She's got places to go, places that she wants to be.
Which is interesting because she's largely been a failure. I mean, Captain Janeway's been successful, right? She is captain of a starship. Even if she got lost in the Delta Quadrant, she's largely met her goals. Mm. Whereas Shannon O'Donnell never succeeded in becoming an astronaut. So in that sense, she's failed in some sense. And she's also had to learn that it's okay just to be happy where she is, that she can be happy with Henry Janeway in a bookstore, and she doesn't have to become an astronaut to be happy.
Yeah, no, exactly. What did you think about Henry Janeway himself?
Well, he's the real surprise, because you would think that someone with the name of Janeway would have... He would be the one to parallel Captain Janeway, right? It's interesting that the writers took it a different direction, where the character not named Janeway is the one she has more in common with, you know, on one of her maternal lines, you know, farther back. I can relate to him. You know, I can be a walking anachronism sometime. I like books and fountain pens and, you know, I like ancient history and all of the... He's interested in history in the past and how the present came to be as a result of the past. You know, where he fails, of course, is looking to the future, right? He looks to the past so much he's stuck in the past. And it really takes Shannon O'Donnell, his encounter with Shannon O'Donnell, to open his eyes to the fact that he can really hold on to the best of the past while looking to the future and being willing to change. And he wouldn't have got there on his own. It really took Shannon O'Donnell to open his eyes to that possibility and to see that he was stuck.
Yeah. See, I find him terribly frustrating.
Well, he's not very nice through a lot of the episode, you know.
Well, no, he's not.
Even though he lets Shannon O'Donnell into his, you know, bookstore for the night.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nicest part he's done in the whole episode, really, wasn't
yeah.
it?
And he, you know, makes coffee, I guess, so that's nice. But, you know, he really has to warm up a bit.
I mean, I guess it comes to the point, like, where do your beliefs and, like, sticking up for what you believe in becomes either not worth it or anymore, or when it comes to stopping what other people want, if that makes sense. Like, he's the only person that is standing in the way of what is potentially going to be making that town a better place. And not only that town, but scientific endeavors as well, purely because he wants to be in his own little bookstore with his books, not going outside of Indiana.
I think he makes a mistake. A lot of people make, I make this mistake sometimes, where you take something that's relatively small and turn it into something big, right? He's really worried about losing his bookstore, which is something pretty small in the grand scheme of things. But he turns it into this almost like a symbol of all the things he believes in, you know, all the culture of the past and the meaningfulness of the past. You know, that bookstore for him is symbolic of everything he believes in. And, you know, what he has to learn is that he can hold on to all of those things, even if his tiny little bookstore that doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things closes its doors. He doesn't have to lose. It doesn't have to become the cause that he thinks it is.
Well, he says himself that it's like Troy.
Right, exactly.
Of all the things that struck me is, why did it take until the end that he could just open a bookstore in this new establishment anyway? I mean, let's face it, 10 years' time, everyone will be reading on little iPads. The bookstore will probably go by the wayside anyway.
It's actually interesting as a side note that the print publishing industry has had a resurgence. Younger people don't actually really like reading on electronic devices. They prefer physical books. So, you know, the predictions we had 10 years ago of this paperless society and all the bookstores shutting their doors and no one owning a physical book anymore has proven completely not to be the case 10 years later or 20 years later in this case.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not one for reading many books. I don't often have the time, but when I do, they are in paper form. And I will admit, I do like my textbooks for uni being in paper form as well.
Oh, it's much, much easier to read for information in a paper book. You can take notes in the margins. You can underline things. It's so much nicer. Mm. Yeah.
It's just nice having something tangible, I guess.
And I guess, is that what it is for Henry Janeway? Does he need that tangible quality? Does he need do books for him represent the past of becoming tangible? He's kind of a historian, right? He cares about the past, you know, its virtues, its culture, its meaningfulness. And all of those things get, I would say, personified for him, or at least concretized in a book. A book is symbolic of all of those things. It's like the book is the living, physical, concrete embodiment of all the things he believes in.
Well, everything's written down for him. Everything is there in front of him in a book, isn't it?
Exactly. So, you know, if that goes away, it's like all of his belief system crumbles with it.
Mm. I like that little scene where he says he's much of a classical person compared to a futurist, and then you've got Shannon O'Donnell saying, but there's no telephones.
I can actually relate to Henry Janeway. I've always had an interest in classics. Like, when I was in college, I took Latin for 3 years, and I took ancient Greek for a year, and I still like keeping up on the languages, and I like reading classical epics. And I think, you know, as I get older, I see how short a lifespan really is, and I hear, you know, like the time frame from our time back to ancient times, a couple thousand years, 2,000 or 3,000 years, 5,000 years in the case of ancient Egyptians. You know, it sounds like a lot, but then you realize, wow, some people really live to 100. Okay, that's only 50 human lifetimes. That's not very much when you start to, you know, look at it in those terms. So as I get older, I think I feel a closer and closer connection to the ancient world, both in terms of seeing how short of a time it really is, and in terms of the way in which we've inherited a lot of our values and conceptual categories from the ancient world.
But is that ancient world accurate to what it actually was, do you reckon?
Well, that's one of the interesting questions that's raised in the episode, right? I mean, Captain Janeway has this view of her ancestors' participation in the first Mars colony And turns out her historical account that she inherited from her family isn't remotely accurate. You know, Shannon O'Donnell is only loosely, barely tangentially related to the events that she was credited for. So it does raise a really interesting question of how much of the past we can really know and how much is inherited correctly or incorrectly, and how much we can reconstruct the past. And even if we can reconstruct, you know, historical events, can we ever really sort of hermeneutically understand the meaningfulness and all of the political and social and cultural aspects of those events? Or do we inherently lose something in the process, and at best we're reconstructing a very inaccurate picture of the past? I do think in my own ancestry work, I'm amazed at how much you really can reconstruct someone's life by the paper trail they leave behind. You know, in the course of a lifetime, in the last 200 or 300 years at least, even before these digital times, people left an amazing paper trail behind, and you can reconstruct at least the events of their life pretty accurately from that. But this episode seems to call that into question. You know, there's a paper trail with Shannon O'Donnell, but when you dive into the paper trail, you realize that the narrative around her and the things she was credited for really are kind of a house of cards that collapse pretty easily when you put the story to scrutiny, like Tom Paris helps her do in the episode.
Well, I mean, and she says it in the episode as well. She goes through all the newspapers and articles about Shannon O'Donnell, and it's all biased, and it's going to be the same for us in real life. Everything from the past is written from someone's point of view. And if someone doesn't necessarily agree with the point of view, it's always going to come across negative. Or if someone's in favor of a point of view, they're going to write about it much more favorably. So then you can go back to the source material, as Captain Janeway says, and it's just someone died on this day, someone was born on this day, they had a kid on this day, they went to hospital, they died of this.
Tuvok makes a really interesting point towards the end of the episode when he basically tells Captain Janeway, it doesn't actually matter whether the story was true. You found inspiration from it that led you to do the things you wanted to do in life. You wouldn't be who you are without that story. So even if the story is false, it served its purpose in your life. So it doesn't matter. Don't lose anything by discovering that the story you valued so much about your ancestor isn't actually true.
Yeah, and to me, that was the whole point and the whole message of the episode. Some people will base their lives off of something that might not necessarily be true, but to them, it's meant something to them. Right, even down to the point that people can take things from TV shows, and a lot of people take a lot from Star Trek and Captain Janeway herself in their own lives that help them and put them on a track to somewhere they want to be. You know, like how Catherine Janeway, the character, has inspired a lot of people and a lot of females in STEM.
I guess I myself have kind of a dual relation to Star Trek fandom in that way, almost a contradictory relation. On the one hand, I sort of go, yeah, that's an amazing vision of the future. We should actively be working towards that, all of the STEM education and the technological innovation that it would take to actually achieve that. And then part of me also thinks that, well, maybe that's kind of a red herring. Maybe what really matters is trying to build that paradise on Earth that you see in the 24th century in Star Trek here right now. You know, all the social and political and cultural aspects that make, you know, life in the Federation the paradise that it is. Why not build that here, whether or not we end up going to outer space and achieving the technological things we see in Star Trek?
Yeah, I'm very much the same. I sometimes sit in my car listening to the multitude of Trek FM podcasts I listen to, and I think, will we ever get to that kind of future? Is it silly thinking about that kind of future when we've got a lot to fix now?
Well, I think Tuvok might rightly say, does it really matter? Yeah. Can't we achieve much of what we see in the Star Trek universe here on Earth, whether or not we ever achieve the exploratory aspects of Star Trek that we see on TV?
We just need to see just a more peaceful and a cleaner future, really, don't we?
Or would that be like being Henry Janeway, stuck not being exploratory, you know, being stuck in our little cultural bookstore?
Yeah.
to use his bookstore as a metaphor for us, you know, can we get stuck? Do we need someone to pry us out of our time period into the future, just like Shannon O'Donnell does for Henry Janeway?
Well, I mean, it's going to take a big collective of us to be able to change some of the issues we have in real life Earth. Just
build the Millennium Gate.
Yeah, that's what we should do.
Build one right now. It's not a Millennium Gate. It's a, you know, the 2020s gate.
It goes back to what I said, though, about your own beliefs potentially affecting a lot of other people. Just like at the moment here in Australia with all the bushfire situation that we've got. Well, I don't want to get too political, but the whole concept of climate change and the issues surrounding our climate are not being heard by certain people because their beliefs are completely anti-climate change. And it's that kind of thing.
I actually think there are definitely exceptions, people who are forward-looking and whatnot, but I think culturally maybe we're not as forward-looking as we used to be. You know, I think, you know, the time period from, say, the post-war period, late 40s or early 1950s, all the way through the millennium, maybe all the way to September 11th here in the United States, I think was generally a progressive period, at least technologically progressive. You know, there were... Think of all the technological innovations. Think of the Cold War ending. You know, it was moving forward, moving forward, moving forward. And then September 11th happened, and it's like, okay, maybe we're not as progressive as we thought we were. You know, I think that took everyone's optimistic vision of what the future could be and brought it down a peg. And we're still, I think, you know, this many years later, recovering from that. And, you know, it's hard to get people to focus on anything beside their own little lives and their own little problems and their own little, you know, microscopic, you know, sliver of time in the overall time span of humanity and get them to set their sights a little further down the horizon, a little higher. And, you know, being in the classroom, teaching again for the first time in 10 years, I'm prepared to just tell students this a lot more directly and just say, hey, you know, life is short. You guys need to have your sights set on the future. Leave a legacy behind. Try to achieve something great for future humanity. And I don't think most people go to college with that kind of long-term optimistic vision in mind for what the future could be. You know, maybe definitely a couple students, of course, but generally and culturally, I don't think most people have that vision of their role in the trajectory of humankind.
Yeah, I agree. Most people will just sit there and worry about what's going on in their own little lives, where they want to be in the future, like you said. And I will say that I am guilty of that, and we're all probably guilty of that. It will take a massive event for the whole world to be able to come together in that view, I guess.
Well, I think what Henry Janeway needed to realize in the episode, it's like he recognizes half of the story. The first half of the story is all of humanity's past, all the great achievements, cultural and technological and societal, that led to the present time, you know, which is the turn of the millennium for him, right? The mistake he's made is to think of his own little slice of time in the history of mankind as the pinnacle of all of that. It's almost like that's the end point. It's all been achieved, and now I've got this little utopia here in my tiny little bookstore in 1999. What he needs to realize is that that's only half the journey. Mankind's past is just barely the beginning, right? We're on the beginning of the trajectory. We've got thousands and millions of years of future human history to come and all these amazing things that will come. And he's made the mistake of thinking that we've achieved it all and you know, 1999 is the pinnacle of human history.
Which we all know a lot more happens after 1999 in the Star Trek world as well.
Unless you want to party like it's 1999. For me, the things that are interesting about this episode aren't so much the episode. You know, I find the episode dramatically a little flat.
Yeah, agreed.
But so I'm always using Star Trek episodes as a mirror for us. Like, what do we take away? And one of the things you see in the episode is the way in which the culture is just changing. You know, this tiny little town, this tiny little bookstore that's comfortable, it's a town where everyone knows everyone, is basically getting bulldozed over so they can build the Millennium Gate. Progress. Think of all the small towns across the United States, probably there in Australia too, that have essentially been bulldozed for the sake of building a city or building something new, building a highway, building a whatever. And that is uncomfortable change for the people who have to adjust their lives. You know, if you're one of the people that loses their house or loses their business for the sake of progress so someone else can prosper, that's painful. That's not a happy change. And from decade to decade to decade, you can see cultural and economic and social change. In fact, we tend to do this nowadays. We look back at decades and we try to categorize them. Like the 50s had its own cultural milieu about it, right? The 60s had its own culture. The 70s, I mean, you can kind of almost go 50s, like, okay, sock hops and greasers. In the 60s, you had, you know, the Beatles and the JFK assassination and you had Woodstock, right? These kinds of things. The '70s, oh, swinging '70s, and the '80s were like, you know, the birth of the yuppie time period. You know, this ultra conservative movements and political optimism, but you know, it's all very, you know, late Cold War era, and you can really categorize the cultures, you know, 10 years at a time. It's fascinating that we almost force culture into these 10-year time periods, and here you and I are. It's literally the birth of a new decade. It's interesting to look back and go, what has been the meaningfulness of the last 10 years, you know, or even 20 years, you know, from 1999 to 2019, 20 years to the day. Here we are, 20 years to the day, plus one from when this episode is supposed to take place. What was the meaningfulness and what were the cultures of those two decades? How will those two decades that we just lived through from this episode to now, how will they be looked at by future historians who look back on those time periods? Are we too close to be able to tell, or can we already say, here's what the defining characteristics of those two decades were?
I would like to think that the defining characteristics of the last decade specifically is progress for minority in terms of LGBT, females in STEM, females in the workplace in general, that kind of thing. I feel like we are moving towards a stronger future in that respect. Obviously, there's still work to go. But I also would think that historians will probably look back on these two decades specifically, and I don't know whether that's just my general mindset at the moment with what's happening in Australia, but a decade of inaction as well.
That's sad if the whole decade is known for inaction.
I know, but that's my current mindset, seeing what's happened recently.
Seven Wonders of the World.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly made up for that episode. Just like a lot of things that happen in Voyager. One episode, someone has an interest.
But Neelix does a pretty good job of assimilating and learning everything there is to learn about life in the Federation, even though it's, you know, half a galaxy away.
Well, I mean, he wants to be a part of it, doesn't he?
Expressing himself in a number of different ways, in a very individualistic way, compared to trying to be masculine and be a CEO of a company. Maybe, I don't know. I sort of think, you know, in the decade from 2000 to 2010, you can say, okay, well, it's a post September 11th era, right? Where it's we had a war, we had various economic things, but it's all defined by our relation to September 11th. And I think you can see that in Star Trek Enterprise. Like, look how much it even bled into Star Trek, right? And then the last 10 years, I don't know. I was thinking about this the other day, trying to think what have the last 10 years, what's happened culturally. You know, we have this resurgence of like totalitarianism and consolidation of power instead of a distribution of power, and you see that globally. Yeah. It's taking place all over the world. I don't think historians will look back on that and think that's a good thing in 100 years. I think that'll be seen as a really destructive period politically.
Well, again, it also depends on who's writing the history and what history they're reading too.
Technologically, we've seen radical connectedness in ways we never would have predicted even 10 years ago.
Oh gosh, yeah, definitely. And I mean, also, it's the birthday of Trek FM too. It's been 10 years since Trek FM started.
Wow.
that's really? What we're going to remember.
Happy birthday to us, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that as well. The world's become probably a little bit more isolated as well as open.
I think individual nations are kind of circling the wagons around themselves, right? It's the sort of vision of a global world where nations cooperate with each other, which arose out of the world wars of the 20th century, right? World War I and World War II. Nations started to realize they had to cooperate with each other, you know, if only for the sake of human rights, but to prevent world wars, to prevent the catastrophes we saw in the 20th century. And I think that political cohesiveness, international cohesiveness, is starting to crumble. Yeah. And that's quite worrisome.
Yeah. That's probably going to be the legacy of the decade.
Hopefully not. You know, I mean, it's the, like, at the dawn of any new decade, the dawn of a new decade can be filled with promise. And I think you see that inside this episode as well. It's the turn of the millennium. If there's ever a time to be optimistic, it's the turn of a millennium, right? The future is filled with promise, according to Shannon O'Donnell. And yeah. Henry Janeway needs to see that the future is still open, still full of possibilities. You know, I think people are very pessimistic. They look at all the bad things going on, going on around them and in the world, and things they hear about in the news, and economically, especially coming out of the out of the recession we had 10 years ago, right, with the economic downturn in 2008, a lot of the few years following that were all colored by that. People had really hard experiences economically. So yeah, why would you look at the future and think it's bright and rosy and filled with promise? Just like coming out of the Great Depression, right? Why would you think, if you lived through the 1930s, why would you think that the future is bright and rosy?
I guess the future is also open to your own making of it, if you know what I mean. Like, you can't, or not necessarily the own making of it, but how you view the things that are happening right now will affect how you personally, on an individual level, will go into the new decade.
Well, that's the, again, I feel like all I'm doing is pointing out problems with Henry Janeway's approach to life.
Because he is a problem.
I disagree with it, essentially. Like, you know, yeah, so his bookstore is going to close its doors. So what do? Do you sit around and pout about it? Like, you know, pick yourself up and make a new bookstore, or make a new goal for yourself. You know, look forward. Don't sit there and sulk about all the things you're losing just because your bookstore is closing.
Well, I mean, one thing summed it up for me, for him, is the fact that he's allergic to chocolate.
Well, yeah, there's that.
Like, that's no fun. He's allergic to niceness.
Is that relevant to Captain Janeway at all? Does she have any relation at all to chocolate? Why is that in the episode?
That's only in the episode because the chocolate chip cookies is a sort of a metaphor on how she goes on something new, but then this time they didn't quite taste right. And because that that situation then brought her back to Henry Janeway. And she told that to him, and she said, I don't like chocolate. But although she goes something like, well, you don't know what you're missing out on. And it's like, well, yeah, he does, because if he eats it, he could probably die if he's that allergic to it.
So it's pretty clear that Captain Janeway inherited a lot, even though the story about her ancestor is false from Shannon O'Donnell. Do you see anything in Henry Janeway that Captain Janeway inherited from his side of the family?
Stubbornness.
Stubbornness, maybe.
Well, I mean, let's face it, she is a little bit stubborn as well, isn't she?
Yeah, she would be the one to sit there and stand on principle, for sure.
But then she would weigh it up overall. I mean, that's what Henry Janeway did in the end. He was brought around by Shannon O'Donnell, and Captain Janeway can be brought around by Chakotay and other members of the crew as well.
But he's sitting there saying, I really, really don't want to own a mall bookstore. I don't want to be in a gigantic Millennium Gate shopping mall.
It's kind of tough, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, he maybe needs to open his eyes a little bit further than we even see in the episode, right?
Yeah.
Okay, is the next goal for him to open another bookstore inside the Millennium Gate? Or maybe he just needs to do something else, probably.
Get out of Indiana.
Get out of Indiana, yes.
Not that there's any problem with Indiana, although I've never been.
Some listener in Indiana is going, oh, darn those To the Journey hosts, bad-mouthing Indiana.
It's like, I apologize, I have never been.
So what did you think about Neelix's interest in the wonders of the ancient world, the seven wonders of the world?
That frustrated me because he was wrong with the Great Wall of China being naked from space with a visible eye.
Yeah, everyone's wrong about that.
I don't know why.
That's one of these things that everyone learns in school, but it's definitely wrong.
Yeah, and it's really basic physics as well. That's the thing. Like, you have to be able to resolve two certain things, and the further you are away, the bigger the gap is that you need on the things that you're looking at to be able to resolve them. So like, if you're in the ISS, you're like 400 or so kilometers up, you're not going to be able to resolve anything that's like smaller than 50 meters. So you will not be able to see that Great Wall of China.
I love that you knew this off the top of your head, exactly how big something needed to be to see it from space.
Because it was something that I learned in physics in first year. Yeah, so I'm sitting in, I'm like, no, doesn't match what I've learned. Do you have any ancestor stories of your own family?
Oh, gosh, you know, that's an interesting question, because I do have so many, and yet I was thinking about this before the episode, that nothing comes particularly to mind. There are ancestors that I tend to identify with, like my paternal grandfather I never met. He was 68 when my dad was born, and was a minister of a Presbyterian church in my hometown for 43 years. And I've got boxes full of his old sermons and all my family members have said that I'm incredibly like him. Mm. You know, temperament, personality, interests, and none of my other relatives have those things. Like, my parents could not be less interested in philosophy. My grandparents, as interesting as they were, and as much as they got from them, are not interested in that way of thinking. And he was. And so, sort of, I feel like I inherited a lot from him, even almost despite my other family members.
And, oh, wow.
And I've always been really interested in learning about him. You know, definitely there are ancestors that have, done interesting things. Like, it's not an ancestor, but my great great grand uncle was the first person to bicycle around the world.
So, wow. His name
was Thomas Stevens. Yeah, seriously. And he's got there's a Wikipedia page about him. So you can look that up if you like. His name was Thomas Stevens. Yeah, it was on an old penny farthing bicycle, you know, the big wheel in front and the tiny little wheel in the back. Yep,
oh,
bicycle
wow.
around the world.
Gosh.
Not
how long
across
ago was
the
that?
Ocean, of course. Oh, late 1800s, I think, or early 1900s. I can't remember the date. I'd have to look it up.
Wow. That's an impressive story for an ancestor.
Yep. One of my great-great-grandfathers was a Swedish parliament member and a school teacher and a beekeeper.
Okay. So have you got ancestry from Sweden?
Yes.
Oh, there you go.
Amongst other places, yeah. The father of that grandfather I mentioned, so my great-grandfather, came from Prussia, and to avoid conscription in the Prussian army, he stowed away on a ship and came to San Francisco in 1854. And I've got a lot of primary source material, letters and documents and business paperwork from him. So, it's interesting. You can kind of use those things to reconstruct someone's life. Yeah. And I have a lot of the original artifacts from those things and in storage. And I like diving into that and really learning about who people were and what they were interested in, what they accomplished. And like, he filed patents for various things, you know, like an ancestor who's an inventor. That's interesting. Okay.
Wow.
I have ancestors that have fought in almost every war in the United States from the Revolutionary War onward. Like, I've got a direct ancestor who was a Revolutionary War soldier, and ancestors on both sides of the Civil War. And another great-grandfather was a airplane mechanic in World War One, and my mm-hmm. other grandfather fought in World War II as a B-24 bomber pilot in World War II. And so all of these are stories, you know, they all feed into who I am and the things that I actually actively let those things define my own sense of self and identity in much the same way that Captain Janeway is doing with Shannon O'Donnell. And I don't think everyone is like that. Some people could not care less about their ancestors. They don't. There's no strong connection between the people that came before them and how people view themselves. But I've always felt a stronger connection to ancestors and family stories and how they feed into different parts of my personality and the things I care about.
Yeah, see, I can't say that I've got any strong connection to ancestors that I've not met. I know my nan, who I have met and still have when she comes to visit. She used to be a traveling opera singer around the UK until she was in her late 30s and settled down. And on my dad's side, and this sort of goes to the point with what Janeway was saying about Shannon O'Donnell, I'm not 100% convinced this is true because the source material is a little bit sketchy. But on my dad's side, my grandmother on my dad's side, she was doing some digging a few years ago and found that potentially one of her ancestors was on the First Fleet. Now, for those who don't know, the First Fleet was the ships that came to Australia to settle Australia as a penal colony from the UK. So apparently one of them was the first officer on one of those ships, apparently.
So is that a thing in Australia? Like, if you are descended from someone on the First Fleet? Is that what you called it? First Fleet? So is that a thing? Like, oh, I'm descended from someone who came here on the First Fleet. Like, here it's the Mayflower. Like, if you're descended from someone who came over on the Mayflower coming to the New World, you know, a large percentage of citizens of the United States are descended from someone on the Mayflower.
And is that a big thing?
And it's a thing. If you can show that, it's just a thing. Like, oh, you're descended from someone on the Mayflower. That's cool. Is it the same kind of thing over there?
No, not really. Australia is so multicultural that you'll be hard-pressed probably to find someone that is a descendant all the way back to 1788.
Oh, interesting.
Because everyone will... Or, I mean, you will be, but not many people will know because, I mean, I think... I think it's about 20% of the country or something wasn't born here, or was only first generation or second generation. It's a massive amount.
I think this kind of thing, for me, it fuels my imagination. Like, you know, there are ancestors I don't know about. You know, for on any given one of my family lines, yeah, it's going to bottom out at a certain point where you don't know who the next ancestor in line was, right? And that's interesting. Like, okay, there are people that I'm descended from that I don't know about. And they were real people who lived their lives and cared about things and accomplished things and had challenges and worries and all the things that people do. And, you know, I wouldn't be here without them.
We could all be related to kings and queens.
Yeah. In fact, I read a study that you can take any two people of European ancestry, and on average, you can find a common ancestor as recent as 700 years ago.
Oh, gosh. Well, good job the bad genes that could occur from, you know, the dodgy things that can happen. would have died out by
then. Well, what you start to realize when you look at the way the numbers work out, you start to realize that, you know, every generation you go back, you've got twice the number of ancestors.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Boom, 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 boom. Except what happens is that after not too many generations, you get more people than have ever lived on the history of the planet.
Yeah.
So what that says is that these trees really mesh and overlap, and people are much more closely related than you'd think. You know, these trees bend back on themselves at a certain point. They don't just keep going and times two, times two, yeah, times two. It's really people marrying and having, you know, children with their own distant relatives. That's why you don't end up with you know, this massive number of ancestors.
Yeah.
And the way the numbers work out. And another interesting statistic on this while we're talking about it is that past a certain point in human history, I forget the exact number, but I read an article on it. But past a certain point, anyone who is alive at that point is statistically likely to be an ancestor of everyone alive today.
Well, that just sort of broke my brain. Can you...
I know, it's weird to think about that. If you go far back in time enough in human history, at a certain, it's like a crossover point almost, yeah, where anyone alive at that point, and prior to that point, is likely to be an ancestor of every living human today.
Gosh, that's an amazing stat.
Statistically.
Yeah, that's an amazing stat.
And it's only like 3 or 4,000 years ago or something. It's not terribly that far back, yeah.
And then you also think that you see some of the amazing things that our ancestors have done. Maybe not everyone has an ancestor that's, you know, been a king or whatever. But what our descendants can do as well. Our descendants could be the equivalent of Picard and Janeway.
That could be. Maybe we'll be the ancestor of some crucial figure in future.
They'll be talking about us on Ancestors Eve. Do you subscribe to the whole idea of New Year's resolutions?
I don't really. Because most people don't really keep their New Year's resolutions. You know, New Year's resolutions are one of these like ultra optimistic things that, you know, 2 weeks in, it goes by the wayside. I really think that, I don't know, maybe this is something I myself get from the ancient world. I think that I got this from the philosopher Aristotle, who basically thought of human virtue in terms of habit formation. That if you're virtuous, you form good habits.
Okay.
And that's not something you do overnight in a New Year's resolution, right? It's a matter of changing something behaviorally over time, cultivating certain behavioral traits. That's not something that a New Year's resolution can do, right? You could sort of promise to try to change your behavioral habits. And that's about as optimistic as I am about New Year's resolutions. But if it's like, I'm going to lose 50 pounds, or I'm going to stop smoking, or I'm going to whatever, it's like, good luck. Let me know how that goes in 2 weeks.
Because most people end up breaking them by the end of January.
Right, because they miss the point, which is that to be genuinely virtuous about something is to form good habits, and that's not something you do overnight.
See, I'm not one to make massive New Year's resolutions. People just see a new year as a new beginning, change themselves, and you're right. It's a long-term change that people have to make. The only time I've had a decent New Year's resolution, because I don't make them all the time, it's only when I think, actually, I really should try and make a long-term change, was probably about 3 years ago. I think it was about 3 years ago. I was watching an episode of TNG, and it was a Picard quote that came on that said that being angry or something, and I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember it off the top of my head, but it was about being angry, and once you are continuously angry, you'll always stay that way or something like that, and it's hard to get out of. And at that point, I was very angry with work and angry at a lot of things that I really needed to try and change that, and it resonated with me in a way that I wanted to change my attitude to a lot of things. And it was sort of that little quote that made me make a New Year's resolution that I feel like I've managed to keep for 3 years.
Yeah, but not because you snap your fingers and it came to fruition, because you worked at it every day.
It took a lot of work. It took a lot of time for me to sit there and look, why am I angry at somebody having an oil leak from their car in a car park? Because I would honestly get really angry and think, why don't they just fix their bloody oil leaks? It's just silly things like that that I saw myself turning into an angry old man, and I didn't want that. And so I made that as a New Year's resolution.
Yeah, if you're worried about that kind of minutiae, then yeah, you're in danger of becoming a bitter old man at your age.
Yeah, well, I mean, at that point I was 26 or 27 and I thought, oh, that's not good. But I mean, I don't usually subscribe to New Year's resolutions because, as you say, you can't keep them unless there is something in particular that you want to change about yourself. And it just so happened that it was that time of year that I realized and I heard that Picard quote. I wish I could remember it off the top of my head, but I can't. It used to be on my blackboard behind me because it really did resonate.
You do have a blackboard behind you for anyone who will not see a picture of where we record. Yeah, you've got a blackboard behind you. That's fascinating. Yeah,
I utilize it for all sorts of things. At the moment, it's got my
uni
stuff.
Not even a whiteboard, an actual chalkboard. Yeah.
Mainly because I can see it clearly with all the different colors.
You are Henry Janeway. You're stuck in the past, man. You got a chalkboard on your wall.
Oh, it's only because it was cheaper than a whiteboard.
Getting back to Henry Janeway and this ancestral connection to Janeway's connection to Shannon O'Donnell, do you find value in this line of thinking, you know, this sort of long-term historical thinking, trajectory of human history, value in the stories of your ancestors? That really resonates with some people. It does with me, but it doesn't everyone. Does it resonate with you, or does it?
I don't really look at the ancestral stuff. And to me, that doesn't factor into much of my life. The whole Henry Janeway storyline in this episode sort of just makes me think a little bit more about where we are going in the future as a human race, because he sort of, in that one character, sums up what a lot of people are doing at the moment in terms of thinking about their own little world, like we've said, and how we need to get over that for quite possibly the good of everyone else.
I actually view life this way. This is a little morbid, but I actually think this really helps put life in perspective. Like, you know, I have my family tree I put together on Ancestry.com, right? If I have in mind that one day I will be nothing but a little box in someone else's family tree, you know, however directly or indirectly, then my task in life is to create an interesting story on what life is and leave something of myself behind. And all of it is going to be compressed inside a little box in a family tree. That puts all of life in perspective.
Yeah.
Like, I think it forces you to think about what's important.
It does. Just quickly, I did find something when researching this episode from one of the writers and directors, Joe Manosky, about what this episode was originally meant to be.
I don't know anything about this because I didn't do my homework before the episode.
So I might just read a little excerpt from somewhere online that I found it. It said that the episode was originally thought up by John Delancey as an idea for a Q episode.
Really?
Yep. So John had a couple of interesting images of Q on an ocean somewhere on a beach, either having lost his complete identity as Q or lost his will to live. And somehow it gets involved with an everyday kind of person, and that person's fate and life somehow affects Q. So that was the idea that John Delancey had. And then Brennan Braga and Joe Manosky went on to say that they were thinking about doing Janeway as a distant ancestor. No, sorry, Janeway's distant ancestor, like we ended up getting in Shannon O'Donnell, but having Q in the year 2000 as well with her. And then they thought about bringing Guinan on as well. So I just thought that was interesting that we could have had a Q and Guinan episode in replacement of what we actually got.
I would like to see that episode, but the episode went through quite a transformation to turn into the episode we actually saw on screen.
Though. Well, yeah, because there's barely any science fiction in
there's
it.
There's no Q. There's no Guinan. There's
sci-fi.
It's not a sci-fi episode at all. I mean,
reflective.
It's, you know, one of the more ordinary pedestrian 20th century stories in all of Star Trek.
Low-grade rom-com.
Yeah, it's a rom-com, essentially. You're right. What did you think about the title of the bookstore? I mean, it was a little on the nose, but calling the bookstore Alexandria Books, I thought was clever at the same time.
I'm going to assume there was something there that I should have picked up on. Is Alexandria...
Well, it's a reference to the Library of Alexandria, which was burned and destroyed.
Right? Saru mentioned that in a Discovery episode, I think, as well, didn't he?
Yes, yeah. I believe so.
Okay. Now they understand the point. Yeah, no, that's a little bit on the nose, but also kind of smart.
Yeah, his bookstore is being metaphorically burned up, you know, in the course of human progress. Yeah.
No, I like it. I mean, it is very obvious to those who know. Do you reckon we could make some New Year's resolutions for our crew?
Goodness, I have no idea. What would Captain Janeway resolve for the new year? Get the crew home
this year. Other than get the crew home, Zachary.
That's the one resolution she's got.
That's what all of them will have.
Okay, let's go down the list real quick. Chakotay,
be more interesting.
Yes.
Because he is... I'm sorry, Suzanne, and you'll be giving me evils right now when you're editing this, but he's not that interesting, really. He was in season one, but if we say this is at the end of season five when 1159 airs, he's not that interesting anymore.
And there was such potential for his character, too. It's really a shame they couldn't find more for him to do on the ship. But
yeah.
But he was a good sound. He was essentially a sounding board for Captain Janeway, right? He helped Captain Janeway's character develop. You know, we didn't care so much about his character, but he was like Tuvok in some way. He was the sounding board for Captain Janeway at the beginning of the series, too.
Yeah. No, exactly. Tuvok wouldn't have any New Year's resolutions. He'd just, you know, Vulcans probably don't.
You don't think he would see the logic of a New Year's resolution?
No, I don't think he would.
He would probably agree with Aristotle that New Year's resolutions are more about habit forming.
Yeah, I agree.
And character than about snap decisions. Exactly.
And the same thing, 7 will be New Year's resolutions are irrelevant.
She would say that, would she? New Year's resolutions are irrelevant.
I do think Janeway, though, needs to or should take the burden of being alone in the Delta Quadrant, like stop it from lying solely on her shoulders, or just be, like you said earlier, be happy with where she is, just like Shannon O'Donnell should just be happy with where she is.
Well, this is what Tom Paris is actually really good at, right? He's good at being happy on Voyager because he was in prison.
Yeah, for him, it's great.
And now he gets to be an officer on a starship in the Delta Quadrant. So he's loving every minute of life on Voyager once he learns how to fit in a bit, especially once he gets married to B'Elanna and they start to settle down and be happy. Mm. He's happy as can be. He says as much. He says
doesn't want to be off the
he
ship.
Tells Harry he is home. He doesn't want to go back to the Alpha Quadrant. He's home already. Yeah. He has no incentive whatsoever to get back. Captain Janeway needs to learn the same lesson, that she could just be happy on Voyager no matter where they are.
Yeah. See, I had nothing for Tom except to let Harry be Captain Proton once in a while.
So what would Harry's be then?
Do anything it takes to become a lieutenant junior grade.
This year I'm going to get promoted.
The same as it's been for the last 5 years. And
longest serving ensign in Starfleet history.
Forever ensign.
Okay, how about B'Elanna?
Anger management lessons?
Anger management lessons, yep. Don't get as angry about things. Yes, okay. The Doctor.
What about he would set his sights on becoming a world-renowned singer that he eventually does in Virtuoso?
Oh, yeah, he's already checked that box.
Oh, but Virtuoso is after Season 5.
Oh, that's right.
So
that's
he'd be the only one to actually achieve it.
He wants to be a real boy.
Oh, the Pinocchio of Star Trek.
Yeah. This year. This is the year. I won't just be photons and force fields. Photons be free.
Be flesh and blood.
Free of his photonic burdens.
And then I guess Neelix, he'll probably just do something unwittingly insufferable or something to someone.
Oh no, just new recipes. He just wants to try a new recipe.
Oh yeah, but they're all going to taste terrible. But yeah.
How about Kes then?
I didn't even have a think about Kes. What do you reckon Kes would do?
The first thing that comes to mind is, you know, maybe she'll get her medical degree. Maybe she'll actually become a doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
Since she's so interested in all things
when
medicine.
She's no longer wandering around like a ball of energy, because I guess that's what she is at the end of season four, hey? So.
Anyone else?
I think that's it. I think that's all of our crew. Yeah. It's been fun talking about 1159 today, but it isn't the only thing we've been discussing on Trek FM. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. To the journey!
Well, I was going to ask this a little bit later, but while we're talking about the Doctor and Seven, let's talk about Voyager relationships. We'll do a quick thumbs up, thumbs down. Doctor Seven, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Thumbs down.
Okay, interesting. How about Chakotay, Janeway?
I like the idea, but I also don't...
The coin is on its edge.
Yeah, but I also don't like the idea of the captain and the first officer being in a relationship.
The ready room.
I mean, I said, okay, sooner, back to all those people for 5 or 6 days before. I thought, oh, God, have they come up with another thing? They've come up with another thing. I remember when Go Big Red was just the big, thing. Okay.
Earl Grey.
They want us to be with them.
The you guys are just taking it to the extreme now.
Joe and I are right.
Kimberly and I are right.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
Why are you wanting to podcast and to be on The Edge?
You had no choice.
Yeah, so,
why, oops, why? That
you get
was
that
me.
Feeling? That's your arm.
I love the sound of my own
riding
voice.
Up your back.
No, so.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode of To the Journey, and there are many ways for you to share your thoughts with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation with us is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select To the Journey. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, speaking of contact information, Liam, when you're not busy planning how you're going to spend this upcoming decade, the new Roaring Twenties, not the old Roaring Twenties of the last century, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the TrekFM network?
So you can find me on Twitter at LS74656, and you can find me in the Babel Conference. Or you can also find me elsewhere on the network on The Edge, Trek FM's dedicated Star Trek Discovery podcast with Nicholas Paul Collinson and Brandi Jaffela. So, Zachary, when you're not condensing your life into a little box on an ancestral tree, where can we find you on the internet?
That's all I do. What are you talking about? Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of MetaTreks, Trek FM show dedicated to Star Trek and philosophy. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Frueling.
If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more available through our special patrons website, The Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, there are a few people from around the network we'd like to thank and acknowledge. We'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, whose role in podcasting history will go unchallenged by all. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. And a special thank you and shout out to our 5 associate producers here on To the Journey. We'd like to thank Bruce Lish, Jude Kim, Richard Marquez, Patrick Carlin, and Norman Lau. Thank you very much for your support of To the Journey and Trek FM.
So join us next time on To the Journey, where we'll be going inside the Millennium Gate to the new Alexandria bookstore. But until then, this has been To the Journey.